I want our children to know who they are, to know what village they're from, to know what tribe they're from, and to have no question about their cultural connection.
A new compact between the state and tribes on child welfare authority on the first day of the annual AFN convention. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, New Talk says a state agency is standing in the way of millions of dollars of relocation funding.
We think that essentially the Homeland Security is attempting to abandon the village.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you that technology for your home is smarter than ever. New devices and apps can simplify tasks, make better use of resources, and transform the way we live. Learn how to update your home with smart technologies at Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's free smart home class on October 25th. Learn more and register at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The state of Alaska has entered into a first-of-its-kind compact to let tribes and tribal organizations take over child welfare services in their communities. State officials say the new Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact, signed today at the 51st Annual Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in downtown Anchorage, is historic and unique in the United States. Its aim is to preserve Alaska Native culture through giving tribes and tribal organizations the ability to directly oversee local child welfare problems rather than social workers coming in from outside their communities, often resulting in children being removed from their communities. Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson says child services comprise some of the most difficult social work her department oversees. She thanked those who do it.
You see things that no adult should ever see about things that happen to children throughout our state. We know that is incredibly hard work, and so we offer our heartfelt kuyana for helping our children to be ultimately who they are meant to be.
The compact allows tribes and tribal organizations to assume certain responsibilities negotiated on an organization-by-organization basis that have been under the purview of the State Office of Children's Services. That includes assisting or conducting investigations of child welfare cases, the placement of children in out-of-home care, and licensing foster homes, among other things. Further along, there will also be decisions on how the state funds those services through the tribes and tribal organizations. Davidson says there are a variety of problems the compact aims to solve. One, she says, is that about 20% of all Alaska children are Alaska Native or American Indian, but Native kids represent more than half of those placed in out-of-home care.
That kind of disproportionality tells us that we know what we're doing right now isn't working and we can do better. Children and families have better outcomes when care is delivered closer to home.
The compact is based on the Alaska Tribal Health Compact, a similar agreement that gives authority to tribes and tribal organizations in managing health care. For Davidson, the health commissioner and Alaska Native herself, the issue of providing more tailored care for kids and families in need is an emotional one. During an interview, her eyes teared up and she jokingly blamed allergies. But Davidson had a somber tone, describing the messages she says she sees on social media all too often.
And they say, I've been told my mom is from this village. I'm wondering if anybody knows who my family is. And we see that all the time, and it is heartbreaking. And in my children's generation, I don't want them to see that anymore. I want our children to know who they are, to know what village they're from, to know what tribe they're from, and to have no question about their cultural connection.
Just before signing the compact, Governor Bill Walker told the convention attendees there may be similar tribal state agreements in the future.
This is just the beginning. There are things, more things we can do with the same process, and you guys have made a significant first step. Really, it's a recipe of what more we can do.
So far, 18 Alaska Native tribes or tribal organizations are part of the new compact, and negotiations to add others will be done on an annual basis, as more than 200 tribes and organizations watch, learn, and make decisions on how they want to handle child welfare services. Earlier on the first full day of the AFN convention, delegates heard an impassioned speech from Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, focused on the state's fiscal situation. Mallott was unsparing in his criticism of state lawmakers who have failed to pass a comprehensive fiscal solution to Alaska's massive revenue gap, instead paying for dwindling government services by drawing on billions from savings.
We hear people say, no new taxes. No new taxes until somehow the government has right-sized itself. We're ready to do that, but let's have a conversation. Let's not use it as an excuse to do nothing, to spend down $14 billion.
Mallott dismissed arguments that per capita spending on services for Alaskans is higher than throughout the lower 48, saying it is a flawed comparison given the state's uniquely rural demographics. He rattled off essential services throughout Alaska that have declined to the point of failing many rural residents and Indigenous communities, particularly education, infrastructure, and criminal justice.
We do not have the public safety services that we need. In rural Alaska, to have a young person be murdered and lay in a rock quarry covered by a tarp for 4 days because police could not get there in order to begin the process of trying to bring a perpetrator to justice. Where is the bloated budget for that?
The speech didn't place explicit blame on either political party or legislative chamber, but set a severe tone just as lawmakers are heading to Juneau next week for a fourth special session that will deal in part with the fiscal situation. Both Mallott and Governor Bill Walker received a warm response from the crowd of delegates. The day's other powerful speech came from the keynote, Sergeant Jody Potts, Director of Public Safety for the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Dressed in full Gwich'in regalia, Potts recounted growing up in a modest dirt floor hunting cabin in Eagle and how pieces of that traditional lifestyle helped her heal after a family tragedy this year.
In March, my children lost their father to suicide. And in the first several months, it was very difficult, as you can imagine, getting through the fog of that grief.
Potts took months off work, spending time with her kids, hunting, and visiting family. She gestured toward the convention's theme on an overhead banner, Strength in Unity, and says that idea was an essential part of how she began to gradually enjoy life again.
The greatest strength that we found was when we came together, me and my three children. We found strength in unity. And I see that among our people, everything we've gone through, we really have strength and unity. We have a joint story that needs to be told.
The convention saw a recorded statement from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who'd had to scrap a planned live video address in order to attend a funeral. Zinke says Alaska Natives have been fortunate under the Trump administration's efforts to streamline regulations, advocate for veterans, and protect the right to sell walrus ivory. He also says Alaska has scored major victories on the personnel side. AFN President Julie Kitka says the recent appointment of an Alaskan to the high-level position in the Interior Department is evidence the Trump administration has an interest in working with the Alaska Native community.
Well, the first significant outcome of our work with the new Trump administration has been the nomination of Tara Sweeney to the High Office of Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs.
Sweeney is the first Alaska Native woman to be put up for that position and will go before the Senate in order to be confirmed. Anna Hoffman of the Yukon-Kuskokwim region was reelected as an AFN co-chair, running for the two-year position unopposed. Television coverage of both the AFN convention as well as the Kwiana cultural festivities is on 360 North and ARCS through Saturday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau school gets a new Tlingit name.
Our language is language to strengthen, encourage, and to give comfort to each other, to one another.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The U.S. Senate voted minutes ago on a measure that could open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling rigs before the end of the year. It's far from a done deal. This is just the first stage in a Senate process known as budget reconciliation. Tonight's vote was 48 to 52 against striking an ANWR-related provision from the Republican budget resolution. Senators are expected to pass the full resolution tonight along party lines. The resolution doesn't have the force of law, but it would get senators to the next step, a reconciliation bill. According to Senate rules, this kind of bill cannot be filibustered, so requires only 51 votes to pass. Republicans hope to use this process to pass tax cuts, too. Assuming the resolution passes, the next forum for the ANWR debate is the Senate Energy Committee, chaired by Senator Lisa Murkowski, a champion of drilling in the refuge. The Village of Neutok says a state agency has blocked its application for federal disaster funding, directing millions of dollars to other Alaska communities. Neutok had planned to use the money to buy out more than a dozen homes at risk of destruction in the rapidly eroding village. Now that funding will likely go to communities in the Matsu Valley. As Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, village leaders say state and federal agencies have made it almost impossible to access funding.
To get a sense of what Neutok is facing, Tribal Administrator Andrew John points out a photo from a storm earlier this month.
What you're looking at here is an airplane photo of the actual storm as it's playing out.
In just that storm, he says, the village lost more than 20 feet of land. The local river is now within 40 feet of the nearest structures. So what is the state doing about it?
Basically, that the Division of Homeland Security has a no-action option with regards to the destruction of Neutok.
That's Neutok's lawyer, Mike Wallery. He says despite years of working with the village, the state has no plan to relocate people if their homes are destroyed this year or next. Neutok has been trying to move for more than a decade, as a combination of thawing permafrost and coastal erosion has brought the water closer and closer. The village has a new site picked out upriver. The big problem is money. In 2015, the state approved a plan to use about $3 million of state and federal disaster funding to relocate a dozen of the most threatened houses. But then the village lost its barge dock to erosion. Moving the homes became impossible. So Neutok asked to use the money to buy out the existing homes and build new houses at the new site. This summer, the state agency in charge of administering the grant, the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, said Neutok's application was incomplete. The division refused to submit the plan to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. So the money Neutok was counting on, it will likely go to Butte and Sutton in the Matsu Borough instead. Wallery says the village was dumbfounded.
We believe that that was dishonest. We believe that that was basically bureaucratic subversion of the plan, and we think that essentially the Homeland Security is attempting to abandon the village.
Mike O'Hare runs the Division of Homeland Security, which is in charge of the funding.
It's bureaucratic. I get it. I'm a bureaucrat, but I have to, you know, we have rules that we have to follow from the federal government.
O'Hare says he understands the village's frustration, but he says Neutok's application was missing key elements, and the division ran out of time to fix the problems.
We're all frustrated. We all want them to succeed. But we have bureaucratic requirements that we have to fulfill. Otherwise, we're being irresponsible with the people's money.
O'Hare says the state faced an August deadline before it would have to return the money to FEMA, so it opted to redirect the funding to communities with complete applications. But the engineering firm Dowell, which prepared Neutok's application, says it was complete, and the state dragged its feet, which ran out the clock. Dowell's Addison Spafford worked on the application for Neutok.
I don't know how to say this, but it's not right. And given the tribe's involvement and investment to try and get these funds to save the people of living in Neutok, it's just pretty unacceptable.
O'Hare says the village can apply for other funding, but that will take time. And Newtalk had hoped to use this money to build in 2018. The village says the bigger picture is that state and federal emergency management agencies are making it almost impossible to access funding. This is the third time in the last 2 years that Newtalk thought funding was on its way, only to be disappointed. Newtalk relocation coordinator Romy Cadiente says agencies keep moving the goalposts.
If this is a doable thing, tell us what we need to do. If it's not, tell us.
The village worries that one or more homes will be lost this winter. Village Council President Paul Charles and Vice President George Carl both live in houses near the edge of the river. Carl says Newtalk needs help now.
If you come to Newtalk, you'll see, you know, the truth of the village, and that they're in a critical condition for some of the houses already. They're ready to fall in the river, you know.
After Alaska's Energy Desk called the state with questions this week, the governor's office intervened. The Newtalk Village Council was called to a meeting Thursday morning with the governor's chief of staff, Scott Kendall, and Major General Lori Hummel, who oversees the Division of Homeland Security. Wallery says both committed to making Newtalk's relocation a priority and proposed using Alaska National Guard units to refurbish and construct housing, while promising to pursue other funding. He says Director O'Hare apologized to the village on behalf of his division. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
The village of Igiagig has been experimenting for several years with a myriad of alternative energy sources. There have been some ups and downs, but they are making slow progress toward reducing their reliance on diesel-generated power. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Gusty winds and the swiftly flowing Quijack River. Igiagig is looking to these forces of nature to tamp down the cost of running diesel generators to power the village of 69 people. They're piloting two different wind energy projects right now, horizontal and vertical access wind turbines. Carl Hill is the Igiagig Village Administrator and the General Manager for Iliamna Lake Contractors.
We have had problems with wind power, both vertical and horizontal access wind turbines. Some of it is associated with frequency fluctuations on our grid. Others are with robustness of the turbines, I guess you could say. But we do have some turbines that are operating fairly well, and we do believe we have a good wind resource here. So we're testing right now.
Horizontal access wind turbines are most likely what you picture when you think of a wind farm. A tower with spinning blades on the side, like a modern-day windmill. Of the six that they've installed, two are operating correctly. One at the village greenhouse and one at a residential home. Two vertical access wind turbines sit on a small hill overlooking the Quijack River. Blades on vertical access wind turbines are, as you might guess, vertical. They spin as a fixed cylinder around a center pole. It looks something like a spinning lampshade. That's a project led by Stanford and the University of Alaska Anchorage, utilizing an approximately $2 million grant from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. It's an experimental design that allows engineers to install a group of turbines in a small area. John DeBeery is a professor at Stanford University who's working on the project.
The conventional industry standard was that you think of each of the wind turbines as an isolated unit, and it just tries to generate as much energy as it can without worrying about the consequences for the air around its neighbors. Well, it turns out that if you do that, then the only way to really design a wind farm effectively is to spread out those turbines as far apart as possible. Well, in many applications like this village, that's not really an option. This is pristine land, and you don't want to dedicate your entire village to energy generation.
This winter, designers hope to test and improve the robustness of the design before installing more vertical access turbines. The village had high hopes for a RivGen run-of-the-river hydropower system. The Ocean Renewable Power Company worked for 3 summers on developing the floating device that they estimate could have offset half of Igiagig's diesel consumption. The U.S. Department of Energy awarded the village just under $400,000 in 2016 for testing and design improvements. But that grant was competitive, and Igiagig was not selected for the grant's next phase. So development of hydropower in the village is on hold.
It's a viable technology, and we think that it could still benefit our village. And the funding source did say that if further funding came down, they would definitely fund our project. The likelihood of that, I think, to be realistic, is fairly slim with the way the budgets are these days.
They haven't given up. Finding another source of funding for that project is a top priority in Igyagig's continual effort to rely on alternative energy. As the village continues to pay between $5.75 and $6.33 for every gallon of diesel, they're committed to finding another way to keep the lights on. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations. GCI is your partner in possibilities.
Gastineau Community School has been renamed SAIC Gastineau Community School. KTOO's Adeline Baxter reports the Juneau School Board voted unanimously on Tuesday to add the traditional Tlingit name, which loosely translates to Spirit Helper.
The Douglas Indian Association says the word reflects the original Tlingit name of the land the school stands on and a need to acknowledge historical trauma the Takukwan of Douglas Island experienced. Several Tlingit community members at the Juneau School Board meeting asked the board to go further. Some suggested simply changing Gastineau's name to SAIC. The board ultimately decided to augment the name. Douglas Indian Association Vice President Paul Marks, or
Kinkodinik of the Tlaquakari clan,
spoke during public comment and said emphasizing SAIC would be more meaningful for students and the community.
Whenever we speak our language, our ancestors are listening and become present with us. And so with that understanding, then they start to guide us. And we believe that our language is taught to us by our Creator. So our language is language to strengthen, encourage, and to give comfort to each other, to one another.
The idea to change the school's name first came up in 2012, when workers renovating Gastineau unexpectedly unearthed the remains of five people buried on the grounds. Gastineau was built on the site of a Takukwan graveyard in 1957. Construction was halted, the remains were reinterred elsewhere, and the city asked the Douglas Indian Association to choose a name to better reflect the site's history. The association finally brought their suggestion back in August. Barbara Cadiente Nelson coordinates Juneau School's K-12 Native Student Success Program and is an executive member of the Douglas Indian Association. She said the tribe considered several names, but ultimately settled on SAIC. She said elders who first responded to the unearthing of the graves did not want the incident to be forgotten.
This significant event unearthed many, many things for us to address and to resolve. Do not let it ever be forgotten. And so by putting the name first, SAIC, I believe really honors their intent. And again, it was a dynamic process, very authentic in presenting the voices of several and the board being responsive to that.
Juneau School's Director of Teacher and Learning Support, Ted Wilson, said the school's website and signage will be updated to reflect the new name. But the school nameplate may take a bit longer.
Because that is concrete, so I don't know what they're going to do about that at this point.
A renaming ceremony is expected to take place sometime this spring. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
The potential for a La Nina weather pattern this winter is looking more and more likely. The latest forecast says there's a 66% chance for La Nina, a figure that's been steadily rising for the last few months. That's according to Brian Brettschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment. He told editor Annie Feit, La Nina typically brings cooler and drier conditions to Alaska, and because of global warming, that may mean a more typical winter.
Since we're comparing against the 1981 to 2010 climate normal period, we're already a couple degrees warmer than that, 1 to 2 degrees warmer than that. So we're starting off, all things being equal, as being pretty far above normal. So the La Nina, and it's not a done deal, but generally it's going to tilt us toward cooler temperatures. So what it's doing is more than likely it's going to send us back a couple degrees, which would put us close to the normal range.
We had a La Nina pattern last winter. How unusual is it to have
back-to-back La Niñas.
It is unusual. It's not unprecedented. And it's not one La Niña. So we had a La Niña last winter, and then it faded away. But now we've transitioning back into a new La Niña. So they are separate events. Again, it's not unprecedented, but it is pretty uncommon. Normally, they're going to be spaced a couple of years apart.
Do we know why we would have two in a row?
Actually, we don't. So El Niños, La Niñas, we kind of understand how they work, and we understand what the atmospheric responses to those events are, but we don't have a good understanding of what initiates them, why they occur. So that's an area of intense research. But for now, we just kind of, we watch the progression of it and don't really have an understanding of why they occur.
So how does the La Niña work, and how does it bring drier, cooler weather to Alaska?
So the El Niños and the La Niñas are actually they're a measure of what the ocean temperatures are in this area of the central tropical Pacific Ocean within 5 degrees of the equator. And it's curious as to, you know, how that affects things in Alaska. And the reason it does is because it's where these warm pools of water set up. So in El Niños, they set up more towards South America. In La Niña years, they set up much more to the west towards, say, Indonesia. And you have these tropical thunderstorms that are sending heat, air movement, masses of air, and that affects large-scale atmospheric circulation patterns called Walker cells. And it also influences which direction the wind is coming from at upper levels. And so in that La Niña year where the warm pool is set up to the west, and that's where the tropical thunderstorms are, we end up with kind of a northerly flow across Alaska, which drags in colder air from farther to the north and limits the amount of moisture that comes in.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove, Zachariah Hughes, Annie Feit, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Avery Lill in Dillingham, and Adeline Baxter in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Nome October 24th and 25th at the Mini Convention Center from 9 to 5. To discuss proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and other issues related to subsistence, the public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.